Monster Man, special episode, classic Universal movie monsters.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers, and in particular, Patreon backer Magnus Levator, or Levator, the Magnus, has asked me to talk about the classic Universal movie monsters, the stars, the antagonists of films released by Universal during the Golden Age of Hollywood, and I'm gonna do it. If you'd like to be like Magnus and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level, and if you do that, in addition to the rewards at lower levels, you'll get the chance to request a topic for a special episode. So Magnus, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Okay, so who are the Universal movie monsters? So Universal released a series, well, they're not really a series because they're not connected at the time, of classic horror films. So we're talking about the Todd Browning Dracula starring Bela Lugosi. We're talking about Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein with Boris Karloff as the monster, directed by James Whale. We're talking about the Wolfman, and then maybe extending as late as the 50s so we can pick up the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Also, some people like to include the Phantom of the Opera and the Invisible Man in that list. Of course, the 1930s Invisible Man, the one with Claude Rains in it. Now, some of these monsters are monsters that we have already covered in their iconic forms in Monster Man, and I don't know how much I've got to say about them, but some of them, I think there's actually a good deal to be said. The Universal Monster movies were standalone products, but pretty quickly they actually began to cross over in a kind of metatextual way, so it's where you get things like, you know, Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein and the Wolfman, or, I mean, that might not be a real movie title, but there certainly were Abbott and Costello crossovers, and then eventually things like the Monster Squad, and Universal's recent ill-fated attempts to create a shared fictional universe, a bit like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, for all of these monsters to inhabit. Chances are that if you are American, your mental image of these monsters will be affected by the Universal version. And I make that exception because I think that British people, when they envision Dracula, are more likely to think of Christopher Lee as Dracula in the Hammer series of Dracula films rather than Bela Lugosi. Speaking of Christopher Lee, it's much more obviously Christopher Lee's Dracula than Bela Lugosi's Dracula. And to some extent, the Marvel Comics Dracula from the Tomb of Dracula that informs D&D's most famous vampire, Strahd von Zarovich. And I actually don't feel like I have a huge amount to say about Dracula here, because vampires in Dungeons & Dragons are very much vampires of these films. Even if they were not originally designed that way, the castle, which gives the creature its own dungeon, and the kind of, you know, when you introduce the idea that Dracula is a boss monster, the contrast between the suave, urbane vampire and the, you know, brutal, savage monsters that serve the vampire is just so compelling, both visually and narratively, that it just keeps turning up. So I genuinely feel like I don't really have much to say about vampires that I haven't already said. They're a classic horror movie monster, and they're a classic example of a monster that shouldn't work in D&D because they're a horror monster, not a fantasy monster, and yet works anyway. But I think for the other Universal movie monsters, there's a good deal more to say. So most of the other Universal movie monsters have some features in common, and those are features that aren't always effectively presented in games. One of the typical features, well, maybe not of all of them, but certainly of the Wolfman and Frankenstein's monster, and arguably the Creature from the Black Lagoon, although some think, and I've seen those movies when I was a kid, that this is a later gloss on the films by later critics, but that those creatures are portrayed in a sympathetic manner. So even though Frankenstein's monster is like the bad guy of Frankenstein, he's a tragic figure. The same is true for Larry Talbot, the Wolfman, right? He is the Wolfman, like it's his last name, like Marv Wolfman. The same is true for Larry Talbot, the Wolfman. He's someone who struggles with the monster side of his nature, this curse that's been inflicted on him. He himself is not a bad guy, necessarily. And those types of sympathetic villains are rarely present in the portrayal of those monsters in Dungeons & Dragons. And interestingly, when there later went on in the early 1990s to be role-playing games about these creatures, so, you know, Vampire the Masquerade, Werewolf the Apocalypse, you know, Werewolf, for instance, very seldom dealt with the idea that the transformation might be unwanted. It's kind of given lip service in some of the texts, but the werewolf is mainly a power fantasy like of individual power within a context of global powerlessness. Interesting, but not necessarily what I would think of as, you know, a good fit to the werewolf metaphor. But that's neither here nor there. I think we can take a look at how these creatures are presented in D&D in a way that, because of the sort of existing monster structure of the game, maybe interferes with their ability to be the kind of sympathetic antagonists that they often are in the Universal Monster movies. To make these creatures really work to their full potential, we're going to need to create sympathy for them among the player characters. Frankenstein's monster is represented in Dungeons & Dragons as the flesh golem, basically a construct created from parts of dead bodies. And the flesh golem is typically not happy about its state. It may resent its creator. It may rage at times. But if we really want to make it sympathetic, we need to establish a little more context. We need to look at the process by which the creature was created, and we need to provide the PCs with some kind of insight into its thinking. Alternatively, we need to create a personal connection to the player characters. And this doesn't typically happen because the flesh golem's role in Dungeons & Dragons is often based not off its kind of narrative context, but off how it functions tactically, if you will. That is to say that it is a muscle monster. So flesh golems are there to beat in heads, and they're very good at that. And so that's kind of the role that they get given. They're enforcers, bodyguards, and whatever. But this doesn't do anything to create a sense of the monster's tragic nature. I mean, for your expression of the monster's tragedy, take the ending of 1935's The Bride of Frankenstein. This is the scene in which the monster, played by Boris Karloff, spares the sympathetic scientist, but blows everyone else to smithereens with that final line, "We belong dead." That's some dark business. You're not going to get that in most encounters with a flesh golem, simply because they tend to be presented, you know, as fights, or, like, whether that's fights to engage in or fights to avoid. One way to get around this would be to introduce some kind of personal connection between the player characters and the monster. Since the monster is made out of dead body parts, it might make sense, for example, to have one of the sources for those body parts be someone that the PCs care about. That could be any kind of sympathetic NPC who's died for whatever reason during the campaign. Whether that's a friend or family member, whether that's an NPC contact that they knew, or even if it's a dead PC, right? Like a member of the party who died. Now that does add a new wrinkle, like one that's slightly different from what you get in those Frankenstein films and in the Flesh Golem as a whole, this idea that there might be something of their old friend or comrade in the monster. But I think it just helps to humanize it, and it helps to make the PCs care about the issue. You know, otherwise, they might think that the monster, you know, creating it is tampering in God's domain, but they might not care very much about that. Something similar goes for the mummy. Not that you necessarily sympathize with the tragedy of the mummy. I've always found the reincarnated Egyptian priestess angle, where the mummy comes back to life and then finds this modern person who is the reincarnation of the princess that he loved in his old life. You know, I don't find that terribly compelling, and it was weird when it turned up in Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. But the more, to me anyway, and this may be just because of my background, having studied archaeology, the more sympathetic aspect of the mummy's motivation is the idea that it is avenging an intrusion into those tombs, right? That there are places that are best left buried, and the mummy is a consequence of that. But also that the mummy sort of has a point, you know, when it is avenging the desecration of a tomb. I talked about this at some length back when we covered Tomb of the Cybermen on Pledge Break. But to make a long story short, the archaeological horror story often involves colonial desecration of ancient tombs. And, you know, again, you can kind of sympathize. No one wants their tomb to be violated. The mummy, or equally often the mummy's sort of sorcerer's handler, sort of has a point. And you're not going to get that kind of punishment of colonial hubris in a Dungeons & Dragons scenario, or at least you're not going to get it in the specific form of the mummy, because the mummy just sort of already has this very clearly defined role in the game, in that it's the big lumbering oaf of the undead, you know, main cast. But you need some kind of context to make it work otherwise. Honestly, I think in a Dungeons & Dragons context, the mummy situation, the mummy scenario, works best without all the mummy trappings or wrappings, as the case may be, as a more or less conventional ghost story, which is how early mummy works often are. The brutish physicality of the mummy is not present in a lot of, like, early writings about animated mummies. One variation on the reincarnated princess idea that I did think was quite good when I saw it was Talos the Mummy. I think it was released in the US sometimes as Tale of the Mummy, which tells you something about how good it was. But that was an effort by Highlander director Russell Mulcahy. And it has a bit where, spoilers for Russell Mulcahy's Talos the Mummy, I guess, but it has a bit where the reincarnated princess turns out not to be the show's female lead, but the male lead, played by Jason Scott Lee, I think. And that works really well, particularly because it's set up as a clever 1-2 punch at the end, but also because, you know, if you think souls travel from body to body, then there's no reason that the body of this contemporary person should physically resemble the reincarnated person. So that was kind of neat. The idea that a character you would not expect might be the mummy's reincarnated love, because reincarnation is an unpredictable process. The Wolfman presents maybe the easiest version of this. You do have to kind of bend the AD&D rules for lycanthropy to make it work. Or maybe you don't. I don't know. The challenge of the Wolfman, the horror of the Wolfman, comes from the idea that there is this aspect to ourselves, this animal side, that is violent, that's dangerous, aggressive, it's greedy, and that is always very close to the surface. And so the transformation into the Wolfman turns into this idea of liberation for the baser urges. This can be used to give clues to the Wolfman's identity, but I think, you know, it's meant to represent a kind of fundamental human duality, that people are capable of acts of violence and brutality, acts that we would say are, you know, quote-unquote animal, but that they also have these higher selves. In fact, specifically, we're told that even a man whose heart is pure and who says his prayers by night can become a wolf, etc., etc. What that means is that we have to take the horror of being the Wolfman and put it into the frame, either by having a player character get bitten or by having someone the player characters care about get bitten. And then the PCs will be more motivated to try and do whatever it is that solves lycanthropy in your game, whether that's, you know, kill the original master werewolf or whatever. You really want to drive home the idea that the character is struggling to restrain those violent animal-like instincts. A bit of a bad rap on wolves, actually, but that's another story. And you can't do that if the werewolf is either just genuinely good, right, where being a lycanthrope is no different from being a redhead, or where lycanthropes are all irredeemably evil. So, in order to make the wolfman work, you want to bite a PC, or you want to bite someone that the PC cares about. The creature from the Black Lagoon poses a problem a bit like the mummy, by which I mean that the context in which the film takes place is something that's very hard to replicate in a Dungeons & Dragons game. In the film, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, the scientists are after the creature because its existence is all by itself important, right? It's this prehistoric creature that survived for however many millions of years and so forth. But you're never going to get that in a game where monsters are at all commonplace, which is what monsters are like in a lot of D&D games. Therefore, you need to do something else with it. It can't simply be like, oh, it's an aquatic humanoid, because, like, yeah, buddy, there's Kuotoa, there's Sohagins, there's Merfolk, etc., etc. The creature needs to be different. I think one way to do that would be to have the creature be extra planar in some way. One can very well imagine a world that has unicorns and mimics and ropers and what have you, but where creatures that come from other planes of existence are seen as being a bit weird. The Phantom of the Opera doesn't necessarily translate very well to Dungeons & Dragons, although I believe that Phantom of the Opera translations have been done. The one really interesting thing about the Phantom of the Opera, and I'm not an expert, I've only heard the novel discussed on H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast and seen the movie, but the Phantom is a monster who comes with his own dungeon. That's the good news. The dungeon is ludicrously implausible, which is the bad news, and he doesn't use it in a very interesting way most of the time, which is also bad news. Still, I think there's some fun to be had in the idea that the dungeon is right underneath where you are already, and that its denizens are leaving the dungeon to check up on the world above, and would have gone unnoticed if it weren't for the fact that their passions kind of ran away from them. Finally, the Invisible Man. One thing I think you can do with the Invisible Man is direct the Invisible Man's anger, or not even anger, because that's not what he's like, but direct his crimes onto people who are not like the player characters. So people who may not have the resources that the PCs have with which to defend themselves from a criminal who can turn himself invisible. There are a lot of different ways that you can turn yourself invisible in D&D. Basically, this is a Gyges the Lydian type story. Gyges the Lydian being the guy in Plato's Republic who gains the ring that turns him invisible, therefore revealing his true character because he's able to act without fear of consequences. So if you have a character in your game who is only being good, only upholding the agreements of society because he would be caught and, you know, either go to jail or at least lose his good job. Like, the ruthlessness, the recklessness that leads to is not as intimidating to D&D player characters than it is to, you know, a small town bar and hotel full of average characters, which is who goes up against the Invisible Man in the Invisible Man. So I think what you want to do is focus on the power of invisibility, which is relatively easy to come by in D&D, and think, well, if the bad guy gets a hold of this power, what is the bad guy going to do? Answer those questions, and you got your Invisible Man.
Okay, final thoughts. Although the classic Universal monster movies are all different from each other, many of them have the same trait of effectively characterizing the monster. And frequently, that involves adding a tragic dimension or emphasizing a tragic dimension where one already existed, like in Frankenstein's monster. Interestingly, Dracula is probably the least tragic Universal movie monster. Maybe one of the reasons that that version of Dracula is hard to replicate is that so much of its power essentially comes from Bela Lugosi's performance. I mean, I've certainly seen the Browning Dracula more than once, and I couldn't tell you anything about it other than the kind of eerie glamour of Lugosi, which sort of goes on to explain why he becomes a horror movie stalwart. That he's very good at portraying that quality of the uncanny. But it does mean that Dracula is quite a tricky Universal monster to apply to a fantasy game, because what's interesting and unique about him is mostly in the presentation rather than in the concept. So maybe with Dracula as a bit of an exception, I think we can say that what makes the Universal movie monsters successful is the way in which they ground and characterize their monsters. And we've looked in particular at the tendency to portray those monsters as not completely tragic figures necessarily, but figures where there is an element of pathos even in the monster being overcome. The creature from the Black Lagoon is presented as a dangerous monster, but one that there's maybe some element of sympathy for. Again, this may be a later reading of those texts, but those movies and the marketing surrounding them were incredibly successful. When we think of iconic movie monsters, we are thinking of the classic Universal movie monsters, and then maybe also Godzilla, and maybe also Christopher Lee as Dracula, and that's kind of it. But in a horror context, you know, I think they're genre-defining. Now, can we then take that same logic and apply it to other monsters? I think in some cases we can. I think it's very useful when the monster is unique. So, the Wolfman, the Mummy, the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Not creatures from the Black Lagoon. You know, you could maybe get away with two Wolfmans or two Mummies. I think two is a good number. But we're always wanting to think of them as characters in a character-focused drama, which is really the thing that distinguishes, you know, these monsters from some other ones. So, any monster that has the potential to be an individual character, so a hag, for instance, and has the potential to have some kind of humanness about them, so again, a hag, or a death knight, I mean, various kinds of undead, doppelganger, I mean, I feel like there are a lot of different, you know, monsters that are typically found alone, that are sentient, and that have some element of humanity to them. So I don't think that you could do the same thing with the Beholder or the Mind Flayer, because their alienness, their unrelatability, is such an important part of their appeal as monsters. You would be taking away something that we like about them, and that, I think, is something that you probably want to avoid. But I do think that if you think about the elements that go into one of the classic Universal monster movies, you can apply those to a lot of monsters. And as long as you're looking for a particular type of scenario, rather than a dungeon encounter, I think all of these monsters suffer a little bit if they're incidental to a scenario. You can put the mummy in that, you know, labyrinth of tombs underneath the pyramid, but he's really got to be a central figure in there, or else the PCs are never going to bother caring about his lost love. The scarabs and the lesser mummies and the skeletons and the deadly asps, those are the incidental monsters to the mummy being the main monster. And I think if you take that approach, you can apply it to a surprisingly wide range of different D&D monsters and actually get pretty good results. Now, I haven't really said anything about using that kind of like spooky Halloween sort of aesthetic that the Universal movies are so associated with, this certain kind of Hollywood gothic. And I think that's partly because I talked about it a little bit in the Monster Mash, and also because I associated so much with Ravenloft as a setting. Maybe one of these days we're going to have to really dig into Ravenloft, but I don't know if it feels on topic for this show. I think that that aesthetic now says to the participant, this is horror, but not really. There are monsters here, but they are fun monsters, not scary monsters. You know, the crooked tombstone, the mist, the clouds covering the face of the moon, the bat flapping from bare tree branch to bare tree branch, all of those things send a particular signal, right? It's the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror kind of look. It's the front yard of that one neighbor who really goes all out on Halloween. And that is great. I'm not knocking that one bit, because ultimately Dungeons & Dragons is not a horror game. It is a fantasy adventure game that effectively adopts the trappings of other genres, like horror, like historical fiction, like mystery, and it can take that kind of like plastic pumpkin Halloween aesthetic and actually use it to send a signal to the players that is the correct signal to send, that we are here for fun adventures, but we're going to do it all agreeing to this like Scooby-Doo spookiness. And I think that can be a lot of fun.
So Magnus, I hope that you enjoyed your episode, and I hope that this covered the Universal movie monsters in a way that you found interesting. I'm sorry that we didn't really talk more about Dracula, but as I previously said, I feel like Dracula's kind of a solved problem. I welcome, however, any suggestions from anyone on using any of these monster types in your game. I'd be delighted to hear how you did it. In our next episode of Monster Man, we're going to have another My Favorite Monster special, and I'm going to be interviewing game creator Eleanor Hingley, and we're going to talk about a monster from medieval literature, which I personally am going to greatly enjoy. But I hope that you do too, next time on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.